going to begin the last class of this quarter. And it has kind of flown by, at least it seems like it has to me. And we're going to be studying the book of Song of Solomon. I didn't ask any questions this time. I hoped you had a chance to at least read the book and read the outline the information that the book provides. It is a difficult book to understand. At least it is for me, and I think that's pretty much the consensus of people who look at it and study it. And there have been a lot of various ideas that have been put forth about it. It's a 3,000-year-old poem or play of love. It's actually written written as a play. If you look at it, it has characters speaking, and it's obviously authored by Solomon. And there's no real serious objection to that. And as I said, written in the form of a play, it is difficult. Because it doesn't really, in a sense, even though it's written as a form of a play, it's not written like our plays where you have the person and then what they say and then the next person what they say. You have to sort of figure out who's speaking, and so it's difficult to determine just how many characters there are, when each one is speaking. The book makes a point that the Hebrew pronouns do allow for you to make a distinction between whether it's a female speaking versus a male, and whether there are individuals speaking or groups speaking. And we see elements of that throughout this particular book. Let's keep going. As I said, it's difficult to interpret, and the language at times seems odd. Some of the compliments are things that if I told my wife that while we were dating, she probably wouldn't be walking in right now. Or she'd be walking in somewhere else, I imagine. But there is a great emphasis on romantic love, either felt during marriage between a man and a wife, or a new bride and her husband, or anticipation of various aspects of marriage. And it does not shy away from the idea of the sexual relationship. That is a part of marriage and is a part of the thing that God created for us to enjoy and to have. And there are aspects of that in this book. And, you know, there's no real problem with that. It is something, again, that God created for our well-being. Now, so how do we interpret it? Well, some people say it's an allegory. It's not even a real story. And this particular view, from what I read, became very prevalent during the Protestant Reformation, as it's called, because people had to try to make sense out of the book. They were trying to say, well, this is a book about a love story. What real message could there be? Why would this be in the Bible otherwise? So they take that and they sort of run with that, and everything that you see is sort of transformed into an idea. Well, this is Christ and the church. And this view is still held among many quote-unquote Christian groups. Many of the Jews would actually look at this and say, well, this is actually describing God's love for Israel. Now, the book and a lot of the authorities that I think we would put a lot of stock in, again, we can't put too much emphasis on what men say, they reject that view. And there's really no evidence other than just that, you know, there are some allusions to marriage, the marriage relationship being Christ and the church of the New Testament. But as the book pointed out, there's no pointing back to Song of Solomon. What a great opportunity that would have been. So the book takes the idea, and Homer Haley, again, a well-respected scholar in many ways, and particularly in things like this, he takes the view that it's actually a historical story. And many Christians would take the idea that it's a real story. It's two principal. Some people say it's two principal characters, Solomon and the Shulamite, and it's describing the husband-wife relationship. And they would also say, well, there are some aspects of Christ and the church there as well. The other viewpoint, the one that we're going to take in the class today, that there are three principal characters: Solomon, the Shulamite, and her shepherd lover. And when we say lover, we're not talking about anything illicit or immoral, but one that she has love for, one that she longs for. And there's no reason to place anything unchaste in this book. There are aspects of, again, in anticipation of the marriage relationship and the things that brings about, and there's really nothing wrong with that, and it will kept within proper propriety. But this is the view that we're going to study. This is the view that that the book takes. You know, we don't have time to have a big debate about it one way or the other. And you had to pick one, so that's the one I'm going to pick. I'm not dogmatic about it, and I'm certainly I only know what I read other smart people say, or what smart people say, because that's the only thing I can go with. So anyway, and maybe you have some different views about that, but that's the one we're going to study. Now, and this was Brother Haley's view for, this is how he viewed this book. And again, I'll let you take that for what it's worth. And again, I'm not going to try to say that he is the end-all authority on everything. Obviously, in many ways, we know that wasn't the case for some of his views. But he says he believed that it was a commendation of true romantic mating love, okay, but a condemnation of Solomon's polygamy. And he bases this on the idea that the Bible is a complete book. And he rejects the idea that, well, the Bible really shouldn't have, people's idea, well, the Bible shouldn't have books in here that have these kind of aspects. Well, what's the purpose of this book? He's saying, well, that is a part of our human experience. Okay, the fact that we have an attraction for a member of the opposite sex and we want to marry them and enjoy that relationship. It's something that God created. And the Bible doesn't really go into a great deal in terms of the courting relationship other than here. So there are things that we can learn from that. And the structure and the evidence within the poem, I think that's part of the reason that the way Bob takes his view of it as well. It lends itself to the idea that there are three principal characters. And if the theme were Solomon's married to a virtuous maiden, what would that mean about all the other women that he married? You know, that would be an endorsement. That would be, okay, he's married this one, while he's also got this other stuff going on with these other women, these 700 wives. Or was it 700 or 1,000? 1,000. Wow. Okay, that's where I'm getting 700. Anyway, that's for whatever it's worth. Now, the story really is that Solomon is trying to lure the Shulamite away. She has this one that she cares for, apparently back home, that she's associated with. And apparently he's nothing on the level of a king. There's nothing in the passage or the story that indicates that he's anything that great other than he's somebody she cares about. And he tries to woo her away with his wealth, power, and charm. And obviously, Solomon had a lot of that at his disposal, right? He was the king. And she is tempted in a way. She's brought in to Solomon, not in an illicit way, but she's brought there to be with him as he tries to woo her and court her. But she remains loyal to her true love, the shepherd. Now, I believe the real big story, one of the big stories, one of the big lessons that we can learn is that we can possess a romantic courtship, attractive, deep love for someone that's deep enough, strong enough to cause us to reject all manner of temptation from superficial attraction. Things like, you know, we should be able to have a love for someone that here comes somebody who's rich and powerful and famous, and even though they do that, we're going to stay with our one true love. And I believe that's one story that you can learn from here. Again, that's all based on the idea and the interpretation that we're taking. And I hope I'm not causing you all to think, what is he talking about? But this is a view that is widely held among Christians. And that doesn't make it the right one, but that's the one we're going to study. Any comment before we start breaking down the book? Right, that's a good point. That's one of the first points I think that Brother Haley point. Where else is there? And it is obviously a great part of our human experience. That sounds kind of, I don't like saying it that way. It sounds almost, not the word, what kind of words I use, the human experience, but that's the only thing I could think of. I read it somewhere and I haven't come up with a better word to describe it. That's just part of our lives. You know, the fact that we court and we mate and we spend hopefully the rest of our lives with that one person. And it is a very strong, important part of our relationship or of our lives. All right, let's break the book down. And it breaks it down into acts. And I'm using a guide. I should have put a note saying where I got this. I think it's based on Brother Haley's, who based his on somebody else's, who probably based theirs on somebody else's. I hope the original guy was right, because if he's not, everybody else is wrong. So anyway, in the very first part of the book, chapter 1, we have in the royal tents, love is introduced, and we have the Shulamite speaking. Look at the very beginning of the book. And we have to kind of figure out who's speaking. Now, most of your Bibles, if it's like mine, it's going to have a little thing out to the left that tells you who they think is speaking. And every Bible that I looked at took the view that there were two principal characters. I have the New American Standard, and it's only got the bride and the bridegroom. Well, bride and bridegroom and the chorus. Now, the book actually takes the idea that there are a lot of different ones speaking. A narrator, the Shulamite, the shepherd, the chorus, obviously Solomon, the Shulamite's brothers, I believe, at least, or maybe I'm mixing that up with another one. But there are different characters speaking at different times. Again, these are assumptions to a degree. But it's kind of based on the evidence within the poem itself. Okay, you have to sort of figure that out as you go. She says, "May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth," in verse 2, "for your love is better than wine. Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil. Therefore, the maidens love you." Now, as I said earlier, some of these compliments sound strange. But if you look at modern day opera and modern day plays, it shouldn't sound that strange, should it? You ever seen things like that? Go to an opera or go to, and sometimes they use sort of flowery language and things like that. And we don't think that's that odd. And if you put this back in the culture of ancient Israel, I don't believe this would have sounded that odd. And again, taking with it the liberty of the idea, this is poetry. This is Hebrew poetry. But she's speaking here. Let me get my notes in front of me because I have to really watch my notes very closely. Verse 4, "The king has brought me into his chambers." Now again, different books will use different interpretations. I followed this one outline. This says in the royal tents. It may be actually in the chambers itself. Look at verse 7. "Tell me of whom my love, whom my soul loves, where do you pasture your flock?" Now, if you ask the question, "Where do you pasture your flock?" does that sound like something Solomon would be involved in? No. Solomon was a king. I don't know if there was any evidence that he ever pastured a flock, even though his family definitely would have been involved in that. But this seems to speak of someone else. The idea here is, a lot of this you're going to see is, you're going to see Solomon speaking and wooing her. And then when she starts talking, she's going to be speaking of her love that she cares about. Any comment? I'm doing a lot of talking here. It does. Verse 5, "I am black but lovely." Now, that may mean that she was well tanned. I don't really know. Right. Apparently, but if you look at the compliments that's given her, obviously she appears to be one that Solomon and the shepherd, as she's speaking of the shepherd, who she's talking for the shepherd at times. It appears as this is one who is a person who is very attractive. At least that's the viewpoint that's given here. I almost see this is a song. Maybe this was a play in a sense. Maybe this was something that was actually presented. I don't know. But you kind of picture yourself in that, watching this play out. Scene 2 begins with chapter 1 and verse 9. "To me, my darling, you are like a mare among the chariots of Pharaoh." Who do you think would give a compliment like that? Man who loved horses, and who would that be? Solomon. That sounds like something Solomon would say. Doesn't sound like a particularly great compliment, but maybe he had a really pretty horse that he was thinking of here. "Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with strings of beads." Verse 15. "How beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are." You'll see that repeated throughout the book, at least in other places in the book. And then you see her respond. And I believe, if I'm right, I'm not totally sure about this, but she says, "How handsome you are, my beloved, and so pleasant. Indeed, our couch is luxuriant." Now, some people will take the view that she's actually again speaking of her shepherd. I'm not sure, but you're seeing her respond here. Now, this is Solomon and the Shulamite in the royal tent here in this little stretch between verse 9 of chapter 1 through 2, verses 7. And then we go to the Shulamite's first song as she begins to remember her lover. It will begin in chapter 2, verse 8. "Listen, my beloved, behold, he is coming, climbing on the mountains, leaping on the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he is standing behind our wall. He is looking through the windows. He is peering through the lattice. My beloved responded and said to me, Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. The winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers have appeared in the land. This is springtime. It's time to, the time has arrived for pruning the vines. The voice of the turtle dove has been heard in our land. The fig tree has ripened its figs. You think about we can understand that. Springtime, and it's associated when we think about the springtime of our lives, the springtime of love. There is an idea that it's not the dead of winter. This is time for something blooming and blossoming. And I think that's the appeal that's being made here. Mobile dove, the clefts of the rock, in a secret place of the steep. This is verse 14. Let me see your form. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your form is lovely. And I believe here that she may actually be speaking for the shepherd. I want to make sure that I have not misrepresented that. Yeah, here she's sort of expressing a daydream of her. Then she's actually hearing the voice of her beloved, but he's not with her like Solomon was. She's actually thinking of someone away from her at this point. And she begins thinking of the rural surroundings in chapter verse 15. My beloved is mine and I am his. He pastures his flock among the lilies. Again, this doesn't sound like a king she's talking about. She's talking about somebody else. Again, owing to this viewpoint that we're taking. Until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of Bethel. Any comment that you want to make? I'm doing a lot of talking. And I know this is hard. Trevor?
I think one of the things that I think is good for us and for young people is better. In chapter 2, verse 7, she says, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the doves of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it's the same thing. In chapter 3, verse 5, do not stir up nor awaken love until one of the things you see as you go through this book is that there's boiling love. There's clearly this restraint. And this idea expressed that restraint must be, otherwise love will be woken up too soon. And so I think there's this theme of self-discipline that you see. I think there's also some other applications we go farther in the book that comes to
mind. Very good point. And again, there is the element of restraint here. Don't stir up love until it pleases, I think it says. Until she pleases, until it's time, until it's appropriate. A very good point. Scene 4 of the first act. She finds her lover. This is beginning in chapter 3. I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys, like a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens. Verse 4. He has brought me to his banquet hall, and his banner is over me is love. Sustain me with raisin cakes, refresh me with apples, because I am lovesick. Let his hand be under my head, and let his right hand embrace me. And again, as the verse that Trevor pointed out, do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. And in the margin, until she pleases, again, it is the idea that it is the appropriate time. Now, chapter 3, verse 6. There is a procession that's entering Jerusalem. Who do you think this would be? This would be Solomon. And actually it tells us in verse 7, what is this that is coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all scented powders of the merchant? Is it the traveling couch of Solomon, 60 men around it, of the mighty men of Israel? Again, this is the idea. This is Solomon coming. And what is Solomon doing? And what's his purpose? Yeah, he's coming to word impressive. I mean, who wouldn't be impressed by this? 60 men traveling around it. Wielders of the sword. Here's some of his mighty men, the expert in war. Each man has a sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. You can be safe if you join up with someone like him. He's made for himself a sedan chair from the timber of Lebanon. He's made it post of silver. It's black of gold and its seat of purple fabric. Purple was something that was associated with luxury. Again, this is the idea that procession is entering, and as Trevor pointed out, he's coming. And he's anticipating of the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. This is something he's coming to try to take her. He wants to marry her. And that really would be the main part of that particular act. Now, Now that he's here, he's going to test her. He's really going to come after her now. He's going to try to woo the Shunammite. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Again, one of those things that sounds odd to us. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes, which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins. But if she was from a shepherd rural environment, she would understand these particular compliments, wouldn't she? Would these be things, in a sense, that would be appealing to her? She would understand what these things look like. A flock of goats coming down from Mount Gilead. Newly shorn ewes, which have come up from their washing. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. I don't think any woman would be bothered by this one. Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David. And again, it goes on with a particular more compliments. And again, some of them are quite graphic in nature. But again, there is nothing, as the book points out, there's really no reason to associate anything untoward or unchaste about this. And again, he is anticipating, as I've read it and understand it, he would anticipate all the aspects of the marriage relationship and what that involves, and the good things about it and the sexual relationship. I think the point is that we can learn is that there is no sin in terms of, as long as it's kept within proper bounds, there's no sin in anticipating that part of the relationship. That would be one of the reasons you would want to marry. And to look forward to that kind of thing. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that idea. I think that's one of the lessons we can learn here. Again, we know that the Bible tells us that it's improper to look to lust. And we can't do that. But having an understanding of what marriage involves and looking forward to that, I don't believe there is anything wrong with that. And that is one of the reasons we get married. If I said anything improper there, I hope not. Okay. And I've lost my place. Again, number of different compliments here really throughout the chapter 4. The Shunammite's second dream. She has a dream again. I've come to my garden, my sister, my bride. I've gathered my myrrh along with my balsam. Again, this is actually Solomon continuing to speak. But we go to verse 2. The Shunammite began speaking again. I was asleep, but my heart was awake. A voice. My beloved was knocking. She's being wooed by Solomon, but who is she thinking about? Her shepherd love. There's some knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the damp of the night. And again, so she says, I arose, verse 5, to open to my beloved. And again, there are various descriptions here that's talking about her attitude of opening to him. My beloved is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head like gold, pure gold. His locks are like clusters of dates and black as a raven. This is verse 11. His eyes are like doves outside streams of waters, bathed in milk and reposed in their setting. His mouth is full of sweetness and is wholly desirable. This is my beloved and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Again, she's speaking, I believe, of her particular love, and she's having this dream and she's thinking about him. I don't believe that he's really there, but she's imagining him to be there. She's dreaming about him being there. Where is your beloved gone, O most beautiful? This is verse chapter 6 and verse 1. I believe this is the chorus speaking now. This is the chorus. Where is your beloved gone, O beautiful among women? Where is your beloved turned so that we may seek him with you? And she answers in verse 2, my beloved has gone down to the garden, to pasture his flocks in the garden and to gather lilies. I am my beloved and my beloved is mine, he who pastures his flock among the lilies. Which side is she going to? Is she allowing Solomon to take her? Nope. She's rejecting Solomon. She's still remaining true to her one true love. Now as verse 4 begins of chapter 6, Solomon's going to try again. This is the third attempt. To try again. You're as beautiful as Tirzah, my darling, as lowly as Jerusalem, and awesome as an army with banners. Again, your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Gilead. Your teeth, again, the same description. I don't know if it was me. Maybe I'd try some different. I'd try a different approach here. I'm not sure. But again, he keeps. Apparently, these are ideas that he thinks will woo her, will attract her. And again, as it continues there, verses 6, 7, 8, and 9, same kind of idea. The queens and the concubines, they praise her, saying, "Who is this that grows like the dawn, as beautiful as the full moon, as pure as the sun, as awesome as an army with banners? I went down to the orchard of nut trees to see the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded or the pomegranates had bloomed." Verse 13, come back, O Shulamite. I believe this is the only place he actually calls her the Shulamite. Come back, that we may gaze at you. Why should you gaze at the Shulamite as at the dance of two companies? Chapter 7, verse 1, how beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curve of your hips are like jewels, the work of your hands like an artist. And again, additional compliments about her entire being, everything about her. And again, some of it is quite graphic in nature. Again, I don't believe there's anything sinful about that. It's in the Bible. It's inspired by God for us to read. So that does not necessarily mean that there is anything untoward. I sometimes believe because of the way our society views things, and maybe rightfully so, there's a certain bit of modesty that's associated with the way we view things, and that's not altogether a bad thing, is it? But if we superimpose that too much, we lose what the Bible is really showing us here. So these compliments are things that he's saying. The fragrance of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. Verse 10, she answers, I am my beloved's and his desires for me. She speaks of her beloved. Come, my beloved, let us go into the country. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us rise early and go into the vineyards to see whether the vine is budded and its blossoms have opened and whether the pomegranates have bloomed. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes have given forth fragrance over our doors, our choice fruits, both new and old, which I have saved up for you, my beloved. She still remains. He has tried three times to woo her, and what has happened every time? Do we all have a marriage like that, or relationships like that? Hopefully we do. You know, hopefully, even though someone powerful, maybe a Hollywood star, might try to woo us, I don't think that's going to happen in my case, but you think about that. What about somebody powerful, politically connected, who tries to approach you, and or someone very rich with all sorts of means to try to take you away? You're just going to go with them? Well, she didn't. She stayed with her one true love, a simple shepherd, someone that she knew already before Solomon. Solomon apparently had saw her, he had spied her, and was attracted to her and wanted her, but it didn't work. Chapter 8 is the end, really, of the, and we call this victorious love. And I'm not even keeping up with my charts, Sam. I'm sorry. Well, I didn't do too bad. I wasn't that off. I thought I was way off. And I'll be honest with you, some of the outlines I read, I could not make sense out of. I don't know where. And this is one from Brother Haley. I could not make sense of the description, so I changed it up a little bit because I think it said something about the mountains of Issachar, and I could not find that anywhere in here. Maybe I just missed it, but it was there approaching their home in the mountains of Issachar. And instead, I just call it love victorious. It did have that aspect of it too. Again, the verse 4, as Trevor's already pointed out, I want you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. Again, there was an appropriate time for that to be brought about, and we understand the remainder of Scripture, that is within the marriage relationship. Who is coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Beneath the apple tree, I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you, and there she was in labor and gave you birth. Put a seal over my heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy is severe as Sheol. It flashes, its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. And again, this is them apparently approaching their home. Who is the beloved coming up from the wilderness? Who is this coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved? Apparently now she's got him, or they're together. She's rejected Solomon, and she's picked the one she really loved. And the very end of the book is that speaking, these are apparently her brothers speaking now. They speak of a little sister who's still young. And I believe the Shulamite begins speaking again in verse 10. And then apparently this is a narrator at the end, or maybe this is the shepherd at the end. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He entrusted the vineyard to caretakers. Each one was to bring 1,000 shekels of silver for its fruit. My very own vineyard is at my disposal. 1,000 shekels are for you, Solomon. 200 are for those who take care of its fruit. Who do you think that's talking about there? I believe the book offers. It seems like the shepherd is speaking. I said a narrator. I believe it's the shepherd. The book says it seems here that the shepherd is speaking of one of the vineyards of Solomon, which he leases. But the shepherd has his own vineyard, the Shunammite, which is sufficient for him. And he has a vineyard that Solomon had a vineyard, but I've got my own vineyard, the one that I love, the one that I've got. And he's speaking to the maiden at the very end. Hurry, my beloved. Or verse 13. O you who sit in the gardens, my companions who are listening for your voice, let me hear it. Hurry, my beloved, and be like the gazelle or young stag on the mountains of spices. So we went through it pretty quick. And we took a particular viewpoint, but I'm sure there's some lessons that you want to point out.
Comment from verse 9, 8, 9. The brother's sleeping there, taking their little sister. Nine, she's a wall versus she's a door. Wall. But if she has the ability to say no to these attacks, we will fill up on her balance and say, we're going to encourage her attacks. Door, if you can open those other attacks, then above the court, see what we're going to
protect. Okay. Very good points. Yeah, I hope you all heard that. If she's a wall, we will build on her an embattlement of silver. That is, we'll support her in that. But if she's not, if she's a door, allowing one to come, we're going to barricade her and prevent it from happening. Very good.
Also, Scott, a palace of silver is worth...
Say again?
A palace of silver is worth a lot more than doors.
Okay, that would make sense as well, wouldn't it? And particularly, they chose the term of silver there. What are some other lessons that you see here?
Says he has come in something. He has put his vote on her. This is truly, and I stand truly in the way of love. It takes quite a man to say that. Seems to be.
You know, the point that you made, one of the reasons that some people rejected the idea of it actually being three principal characters is that they had a hard time believing that Solomon would have written something that put him in a bad light. Solomon was the one that lost out here. But if you think about the point that Charles is making here, is that really the point of it is that the person who had all these things available to him in terms of material type things didn't have the one true thing that it really took. And that would have been his own personal character. And he was not able to overcome what she saw in this other young man. We really don't know what she saw in this other person other than this is just someone that she had decided to love. And one point to remember, and I don't know if this book brings this out so much, but love is a decision to a degree, to a large degree. We decide that we're going to love somebody. You know, there is a romantic, attractive element to our relationships. And that is a part of it. It's a strong part of it. But there's another part of it, too. There is a commitment side to it. And is the idea that you have decided you're going to put yourself towards this other person, and you're not going to allow these other things to prevent you from keeping that commitment. And it is a decision to a large degree. And I think we all need to understand that. People get into a marriage relationship and they say, well, I don't love my spouse anymore. Well, we need to repent and change our hearts and decide to love our spouse again. Okay, that's the point that the Bible makes in terms of the kind of relationship that we have, that we're supposed to have. So, very good point there, Charles. Again, this could say something about Solomon's character at this point. I think we all like to hold to the idea that Solomon at some point in his life repented, and hopefully he did. I think we want to believe that. There's no evidence in the chronology that he did. But if we take the story here, take the story of Ecclesiastes, and look at the many proverbs that he spoke, you know, there's a reason to have hope for Solomon. There's reason to cling to some little bit of hope that he did. And again, this would support that as well. Any other comment?
I'm going to work. The people that we needed in a worldly sense. And as we talked about several of those people, we came across the fact that they were married more than once. paid the on probation. He didn't get to where he's got that kind of money and that kind of power. He said, even though he's married, he had to say no to trouble. That may happen repeatedly. The fact that this woman did not succumb to this power and this money says something remarkable about her.
Yeah, she obviously did have a strong character. That's the way she's presented here. The way she's portrayed is one who is of strong character, one who is committed to this one person, and she's not going to let this other thing sway her. Now, in a greater, beyond romantic relationship, if there is some lesson there beyond that, shouldn't we have that kind of love for God? You know, are we going to allow things of the world to pull us away and cause us to leave God and turn on our one true love, the very one that we've committed ourselves to? You know, if we can have that in the romantic type of relationship, surely we should have that for God, who offers something even greater. So the book, and maybe that is another lesson there. So anyway, I appreciate your comments. Appreciate all your attentiveness, and I've enjoyed teaching the class, and I'm sure I treat the fleet for Trevor as well. This was an enjoyable quarter, for both of us, and I appreciate everything. And next time we'll start picking up. New teachers will pick up with Divided Kingdom. I'm supposed to know my. I had to sit there and think about it. Divided Kingdom.
I'm going to make one comment on this. We obviously don't have the time to do it, but I think you can go back and look at the compliments. You see, if you take the three-person approach, you see Solomon becoming more and more and aggressive in compliments, and I think pushing a line too far. So if you take the time to go back and look at those and see her reaction, I think you get a very good definition of what is modest and what is appropriate, and I think we see some lines drawn.
Good point. I think I remember reading that somewhere, that you do see an increased aggressiveness on the part of him as he, again, makes his appeal. I think there were three times he made an appeal. Was it three or four? Three. He makes that appeal. She answers. She's still with her beloved. He makes that appeal again, a little stronger. So, very good point. Very good point. Thank you. Appreciate that.